Welcome to Torat Imecha with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Amy Horowitz, and this week we'll be learning Parshat Bahalotcha. Parshat Bahalotcha represents a turning point for the Jewish people as they finally take leave of Har Sinai and begin their journey towards the land of Israel. As we mentioned in the previous 2 weeks' Parshiot, B'nai Yisrael prepare to leave Har Sinai with great optimism. They prepare their camp, prepare their army, and get themselves ready to enter and conquer the land they've been waiting to inherit since the days of Avraham. At the beginning of this week's Parsha, they're putting the finishing touches on these arrangements. Aaron is given his special role of lighting the menorah in the Mishkan, and the Levium are set apart and consecrated for their role in the Mishkan as well. It's at this point in the Torah that the Levium officially take over the role that was previously designated for the firstborn sons, following a pattern set in Sefer Breishit of the Bechor losing his birthright to a brother more worthy. Once the roles of the Levium and Kohanim are set and clear, it's time to bring the first anniversary Korban Pesach, an opportunity for B'nai Yisrael to remind themselves of the great miracles Hashem did for them just 1 year earlier in Egypt. The Torah includes a mention of another worthy group of individuals, the Chevra Kedisha in the Midbar, who are not able to purify themselves in time to bring the Korban Pesach along with the rest of the Jewish community. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in his Sefer Drash Moshe, suggests that, based on the principle of Ha'osek B'mitzvah Pater Min HaMitzvah, these men were not obligated to bring the Korban Pesach as they were busy with another mitzvah, that of burying the dead at the same time. However, says Rav Moshe, these men are disheartened by the fact that they can't participate in the communal Korban Pesach. Despite being exempt, they're eager to perform the mitzvah anyway, and so Hashem responds to their request for a second chance by instituting the holiday of Pesach Sheni a month after Pesach on the 14th of Iyar. After bringing the Korban Pesach, which according to our Mefarshim is the first and last one for the duration of the 40 years in the Midbar, the Jews get their literal marching orders to assemble when they hear the sound of the trumpets and to follow the Anane HaKavod as they march. These trumpets, the Chatzotzrot, will be blown during war and again on joyous occasions to remind the Jewish people of Hashem's presence in their lives. And then, on Chaf Iyar, at the completion of 13 months in the wilderness, mostly spent camped at Har Sinai, finally, they're off. Moshe invites his father-in-law Yisro to join the Jewish people with the joyous words, Nosim anachnu el hamakom asher amar Hashem oto etein lachem. Come on, let's go. We're headed to the promised land. Yisro declines the invitation and the Jewish people begin their journey without him. But instead of marching directly and gloriously into Eretz Yisrael, things take an immediate wrong turn. 3 days into their march, they begin to complain. Why is this taking so long? We're hungry. We don't like eating the man. We much prefer the food we ate in Egypt. Why did God take us out of Egypt anyway? We liked it better there. Anyone who's ever taken a road trip with young children can very much relate to the frustrating nature of these questions. But even more than frustrating, the rapid turn of events midway through the Parsha is mind-boggling. How does this happen? Where do the Jews go wrong? How does their year at Har Sinai and their enthusiasm to perform the Korban Pesach just disappear? The Ramban offers a disturbing suggestion. He describes B'nai Yisrael fleeing from Har Sinai, ketinok haboreach mibeit ha-sefer, like a child running away from school on the last day. I'm a high school teacher, so this image is very vivid to me. As much as I know it's not personal, it really does hurt me to see my students gleefully trash their notebooks and worksheets from a whole year of learning. Why are the Jewish people running away from Har Sinai like they can't get away fast enough? Ramban suggests they're afraid that if they stay 1 minute longer, they'll have to accept more mitzvot. This fits in nicely with Sifsei Chachamim's explanation of the people's rose-colored memory that in Egypt they ate food for free. He explains that of course they didn't eat for free, they didn't even get the straw to make bricks for free. But in Egypt, their food was free of the condition that they observed the mitzvot. Now that they've received the Torah, they're bound by the words we say every day in our Shema. V'haya im shamoa tishme'u el mitzvotai, v'asavta deganecha tiroshcha v'itzarecha, v'achalta v'savata. If we observe the mitzvot, we'll reap a bountiful harvest so that we can eat to our satisfaction. But the opposite is also true. Hishamru lachem penif telavavchem, v'chara af Hashem bachem v'atzar et hashamayim, v'lo yiyem matar v'ha'adama lo titein et yivula. If we fail to properly observe the mitzvot, the ground won't yield its produce and we'll go hungry. So the new reality is that our food is not free at all, but is conditional on our observance of the Torah's laws. Just a few psukim later, Moshe hears the people crying, lemishpechotav, by families. Chazal in Masechet Yuma explain that this doesn't actually mean that the people were crying by families, but that the people were crying about family matters. This is a reference to all the laws governing relationships and intimacy that the nation just received at Har Sinai, and which they were clearly feeling distressed about. They're feeling overwhelmed, overburdened, overtaxed by their new obligation to perform mitzvot that touch every crevice of their lives. They're feeling like this whole Torah thing is just too hard, and so they run away from Har Sinai like my students on the last day of school. They seem to have had enough, and their frustration is clear. And it's not just about mitzvot. Their whole perspective seems to have shifted. Looking carefully at the psukim that precede their complaints, something interesting emerges. When Moshe urges Yisro to join the Jews on their journey into Israel, he uses the word tov in some form or another 5 times in just a few short psukim. He's selling and maybe even overselling how good it would be for Yisro to come along on the trip. Shortly thereafter, when Hashem describes to Moshe the Jews' complaints about their lack of meat, he accuses them of saying ki tov lanu b'mitzrayim. Again, we find the use of the word tov, but now it's being used to describe the land of Egypt. It's as if, upon leaving Har Sinai, the Jewish people have completely shifted their perspective and changed their entire definition of tov. It used to be that the land of Israel was their reference point for what was good, but now it's as if Egypt is the good and promised land. This idea that good and bad is all a matter of perspective seems like a thread that winds its way throughout this week's Parsha. The Jews complain about the man, failing to see its objective goodness. Instead, they focus on its flaws. It dries them out. They're always looking to the sky, waiting and wondering if the man will fall and provide them with food for another day. Instead, they want meat. Meat, they feel, is objectively good. But is that true? When Hashem responds to their request, he sends them quail, so much that they eat until they're full and then sick. What they thought would be good turned out to be disgusting. At around the same time in the Parsha, 2 men named Eldad and Medad receive nevuah in the camp. Someone runs to fill Moshe in on what they're sure is a scandal. Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. This is initially viewed as totally inappropriate, as Moshe is the singular Navi and their exclusive liaison with Hashem. But when Moshe hears the news, he's actually delighted. Umi yitain kol am Hashem nevi'im. He says, I wish everyone was a Navi. Not only does this speak to Moshe's legendary humility, but it's another example of the underlying message of this Parsha, that good and bad are not objective, but subjective. The Parsha doesn't end here. The final section of Parshat Baha'alotcha tells the story of Miriam and Aaron speaking Lashon Hara about their brother Moshe. Rashi explains what it is they were gossiping about. Miriam was standing by her sister-in-law Zipporah's side when Eldad and Medad received their nevuah. Zipporah's reaction came as a surprise to Miriam. Zipporah expressed sadness for their wives because now they would have to separate from their husbands like she, Zipporah, had to separate from Moshe. This is new information for Miriam, and she's eager to share this with Aaron, but not just for the sake of idle gossip. She's upset. Who does Moshe think he is? Does he think he's unique as a Navi that he has to separate from his wife? Miriam and Aaron have also received nevuah, and yet they remain intimate with their spouses. What's the deal with Moshe? He must think he's very special. This is yet another example of the shift in perspective that affected the entire Am Yisrael after they left Har Sinai. What they should view as good, like the mitzvot and the man and the land of Israel, they view negatively. Moshe's level of nevuah is as epic as his humility, and it's almost impossible to imagine that Miriam and Aaron could view Moshe in anything other than a positive light. But they do. They accuse Moshe, the humblest of men, of having an ego. They deride his lofty status as a Navi, and they mock his decision to separate from his wife. And Hashem rushes to Moshe's defense. According to Rashi, Hashem appears to Miriam and Aaron suddenly to give them a taste of Moshe's reality. He's on call for nevuah 24/7 and simply wants to make sure he's prepared, which is why he felt he had to separate from Zipporah. It wasn't an ego move. It's something Moshe felt was a necessity and was actually a tremendous self-sacrifice. And instead of Miriam and Aaron talking about it, they could have sympathized with Zipporah and by extension Moshe. Instead, they took it personally and chose to view it with scorn. This is the unfortunate new perspective that accompanies the Jewish people as they leave Har Sinai, and it follows them for 39 years. This perspective threads its way through the next several parshiot, as the spies choose how and what to report back to the nation after their foray into the land of Israel, and as Korach accuses Moshe and Aaron of ego and greed. Part of Bnei Yisrael's journey over the next 39 years is to shed this lens that casts what's good in a bad light and glorifies what's bad and makes it seem alluring. And this harkens back to the very first parsha, Parshat Bereishit, when Adam and Chava eat the fruit from the Eitz Hadaat and introduce the concept of Tov Vara into the human experience. One explanation of that enigmatic episode is that before Adam and Chava ate that fruit, good and bad were separate and objective concepts. After they ate the fruit, however, everything in the world became a jumble of Tov Vara, where good and bad were now indistinguishable and subjective. This is both a blessing and a curse. The curse, of course, is when we see everything with a negative lens. Talk show host Dennis Prager coined the term missing tile syndrome. This is the phenomenon where someone walks into a room that is beautifully appointed and magnificently furnished, and yet immediately focuses on the one missing tile. Missing tile syndrome means we focus on what's wrong instead of what's right. However, the subjectivity in good and bad is also a blessing. This gives us the power to choose to see what's positive, even in a challenging situation. We can use the subjectivity of Tov Vara to choose how we wish to view everything that happens in our own lives. We can view the mitzvot as a burden, like Bnei Yisrael seemingly did as they ran away from Har Sinai, or as a gift, a way to elevate the mundane actions of our day-to-day life into Avodas Hashem. This week's Parsha begins a period of struggle in our history. Leaving Har Sinai becomes a metaphor for a challenging shift in perspective that we have to learn how to fight and overcome. With the holiday of Shavuos still visible in our rearview mirror, let's ensure that we don't fall into the same pattern of thinking as our ancestors did. We can and should choose to focus on what's positive, even when there are tiles that are missing. The power of perspective is ours. Have a wonderful Shabbos, and thank you for learning Parshat Baha'alotcha with the OU Women's Initiative.